Welcome back to the Squawker Talker. My name is Nick English, and we've got a bit of a different pod planned for you today. So essentially what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about the international football that happened yesterday, what's coming up today, and then we're going to rerun an edited version of one of our old interviews, Rory Briggs talking to James Montagu, aka the Indiana Jones of football writing. Really, really good interview that he did last year at, I can't remember exactly when, but it was a very, very good interview. Really interesting. Yeah, we'll be getting to that quite soon. In the meantime, I'm joined by Adam Hamdani. Hello, Adam.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Looking forward to bashing England a little bit.
Yeah. Is that a favourite pastime of yours?
Always, especially when they bore me with a 1-0 like last night.
All right, okay. Well, there's going to be a lot of discussion about that. And also joining us is Hush Karai. Hello, Hush.
Hello, everyone.
I can't actually see you, Hush.
No, that's how I like it.
Yeah, fair enough. There's quite a large soundproofing instrument in the way, which means we can't really see each other.
I've got a pretty small face as well.
You've got a small face.
Oh, wow. Early shots.
There we go. Let's see how that cogitates. So yeah, Adam, let's start off by talking about England. I think everyone was pretty unanimous in thinking that they were absolutely dreadful until probably the last 15 minutes, where it seemed to pick up a bit and the game stretched, and eventually they got the goal that they needed. But a bit of a letdown of a display. Or is it harsh to criticise a team when they're playing against a Slovenia side that had at some point, eight or nine men in the penalty area?
I think you're right in that sense. Like, everyone sort of acknowledged that at the same time, that they were being really defensive and it was quite unfair on England's attackers. But with the players that they have up front, like Rashford, Kane, even though Oxlade-Chamberlain was awful, he should still be creative enough to be able to unlock a defence like that.
Mm.
And it only came once Slovenia clearly tied at the end and Kyle Walker bombed down the wing and actually played that ball into Kane. And it was a good finish, but it kind of like trickled in at the same time. So it was a good performance. It was an average performance from England, good performance from Slovenia defensively, but going into the World Cup, it doesn't look that positive at the moment. And I think we've got friendlies against Germany and Brazil in November, both at Wembley.
Should be fun.
If we can get results out of those, then it's like a big confidence booster for England going into the big tournament.
Hush, I mean, we'll talk a bit about what the plan is going forward, because everyone's a bit confused about what Southgate wants to do formation-wise, but it very much seemed like a safe sort of approach from England yesterday. It was very much, let's keep the ball as much as possible, tie them out, and they only tie it out at the very, very end. Do you think Southgate managed this one correctly? He should have been a bit more gung-ho. The reality of it is that England are going to the World Cup.
Yeah, well, job done, first of all. But yeah, it's being too kind to Southgate if you're saying that, you know, Slovenia being defensive sort of made England look worse than they are, because we played two holding midfielders against Malta away. And at that point, everyone was saying, what's the point of Dyer and Henderson in the same midfield? It's, you know, they're both the same kind of player. They don't sort of turn on the ball. They don't pass forwards enough. And going into the Slovenia match, like, it's not a surprise that they were defensive. They were always going to do that at Wembley. So it was down to us to, you know, set England up, or down to Southgate to set England up so they could be a bit more creative, get players into channels in behind their defence and midfield. And yeah, picking Darren Henderson, it's not going to work. And it's kind of symptomatic of the sort of selection, I guess, policy of Southgate or the FA, if it's not purely him picking these players, because a lot of players like Oxlade-Chamberlain are in the squad. Well, Oxlade-Chamberlain started last night. That, you know, he can't get a game for Liverpool in the position he wants to play.
Well, let's talk about that, because he was pretty abject yesterday. He's been pretty abject for a while, Adam. I mean, there's a quite amusing clip where he tries to spit and he ends up spitting on himself.
Yeah.
And then he went off and kicked a water bottle rather unconvincingly as well. I mean, what was the point in starting him yesterday when you've got so much talent out wide who are in form?
I think, like, everyone's going to blame him, I think, and obviously Southgate as well, for picking him. But why would you pick someone who's not starting for their club? And Oxlade-Chamberlain is a huge confidence player. Like, we were speaking about it yesterday, that when he's on the ball, he's the best at getting you into the final third.
Yeah.
But once he's in the final third, unless he's got loads of confidence and not a lot of time to think, he doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't have a clue what to do with it. So picking someone that's not starting in even their favoured position for their club, not even starting at all, putting him straight in for you know, a really important qualifier, it's never going to go well.
One player who's definitely not short of confidence, Hush, is Harry Kane. That's 11 goals for England in 22 games. It continues his ridiculous goal-scoring form. I mean, it's great for England that they just have a number nine who's just plays through the middle, can play in a two, play in a one, and you know he's got goals in him. They needed him yesterday, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Well, thank God he plays for England, and thank, you know, he did save what could have been a pretty embarrassing night for Southgate. And with the sort of, you know, the last few remaining people still questioning his credibility as a world-class striker, I think similar to the way Lewandowski sort of, you know, propels Poland into international tournaments and keeps them, you know, just behind the sort of top nations in world football, I think Harry Kane has the same effect with England, because without him, we look distinctly average, and his sort of finishing ability at least, you know, gives us some hope.
Yeah, some hope.
Some hope.
You say that so forlornly.
Because you don't have to give him a lot and he'll score goals. Yeah. So you can score goals out of nothing. And
even at Wembley now.
Yeah, even at Wembley.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about going forward. We've got, you know, we're talking about Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, Dele Alli, Harry Kane. Some great forward talent, you know, Jesse Lingard on the bench. You know, there's a lot of really talented. Jamie Vardy's always good for a goal. What should be the approach for England going forward? As we mentioned, they've got these two friendlies against Germany and Brazil. I mean, it looks like England are well suited to being a counter-attacking side, with all that pace they've got up front. What should be the approach that Southgate takes? Because basically, from this moment forward, it's all prep for the World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's, you got to manage it game by game. So like Hush was saying, against the Slovenia yesterday, why you're playing Dier and Henderson as a two when you could play that one defensive midfielder and then have all the creative players around him going forward. Against someone like that, do that sort of thing. But against the Germany, who, I think the last time we played Germany, we lost, didn't we? When Podolski scored that goal in his final game. So against a team like that, when we know we're probably the second best team in the game, that's when you have a Dier Henderson or a Dier and whoever's a defensive midfielder in that sort of situation. And then you put the creative players around them. And then that's your solid base and the attacking, fast, counter-attacking players going forward. Doing it, Henderson and Dier in, against small teams, I should say, doesn't really work, because you're not using your assets that wisely, I think.
I think there's a disconnect between the forwards and the midfield. So Sterling, Rashford and Kane, who all three of them played pretty well last night, Rashford in particular, but there's just no link-up play between the midfield and the strikers. We missed...
Well, doesn't seem to move quickly enough through the phases, does it?
Exactly. So Dele Alli, who was suspended, plays the in-between role and can carry the ball from midfield into the attack. Adam Lallana, who's not played for England for a while through injury, we look a much better team with him in the side, because he helps that transition. It's not sort of all the pressure isn't on Dier and Henderson to pick up the ball in midfield, turn and find someone, which they have their own limitations. They can sort of be creative at times, but they're just not that sort of player. So
they're not the sort of player to constantly ask questions like Adam Lallana does.
Exactly.
So there's Lithuania away. That's on Sunday.
Yeah.
Sunday.
Yep.
So should it already be time for Southgate to be like, right, okay, let's try what I want to do at the World Cup is like, you know, is it going to be three at the back? And the only little bit of credit that I would point out for Southgate yesterday is that he switched to a three at the back, and it was actually putting Walker at right wing back, which led to the goal. So credit Southgate for that. But is that something that he should go with against Lithuania and just sort of be like, right, this is going to be our formation for the World Cup? Or do you think he still needs to adopt a pragmatic approach?
I think it's still pretty early to work on, you know, your final team for the World Cup. Obviously, you want to have as much prep as possible. I think yesterday was like his 11th game or something, which isn't really loads before going into your first major tournament. So he has time to sort of figure out what he does want. But those two games, Germany and Brazil, they're the acid tests of your key moments of what's going to come up, because they will come with their best players, and their best players are the best in the world.
They are pretty good. Joshua Kimmich especially on fire for Germany at the moment. A couple of question marks still over the England squad, Hush. First choice goalkeeper and captain. Harry Kane captain yesterday. He doesn't captain Spurs, Hugo Lloris does, but he seems like a very good captain candidate. Weirdly, Gary Cahill was playing. He captains Chelsea, but Southgate doesn't fancy him for whatever reason. Also, when it comes to the issue of goalkeeper, Joe Hart was very good yesterday, had quite a decent game, but Jack Butland and Jordan Pickford seem to be picks for the future. So how would you resolve both of those situations?
The captaincy issue, I personally was against Harry Kane being captain, because I remember when Aaron Ramsey got the Welsh captaincy a couple of years ago, when he was like the sort of poster boy of Welsh football, apart from Gareth Bale, obviously. And about 6 months later, they took it away from him because it was affecting his performances.
Yeah.
I thought Harry Kane might sort of suffer from something similar, but yeah, yeah. I was wrong about that. From
the Harry Kane's made of steel.
Yeah. From the evidence of last night, he can hold the captaincy and still be the star striker,
yeah,
and give all the media, you know, obligations and what have you, and still carry on with it. Gary Cahill, I can understand why he's not captain, because I don't think he'll be in the side by the Euros in the summer. Oh, yeah? I don't think so.
The Euros?
The World Cup, sorry. because he's slowly being sort of phased out of the Chelsea starting 11.
Do you think it'd be Stones and Keane?
Ooh, I'd say Stones, definitely. Whoever partners him. I've got a sneaky feeling Phil Jones might have
played
enough for United. Yeah, he seems to be getting into Mourinho's good books. And yeah, you know, Fergie called him the best ever player or something a couple of years ago. So I think Jones and Stones might be the pairing. And yeah, I wouldn't really put too much impetus on keeping Gary Cahill involved in that situation much.
What about the goalkeeper situation, Adam? I mean, you see Joe Hart play like he did yesterday. He sort of like goes that Champions League mode where he's just saving everything, putting his body on the line, being super brave, super loud. But you can't help feeling that he's always got a clangor in him. And when you've got talents such as Jordan Pickford for just his distribution alone, and Jack Butland for his unbelievable shot-stopping ability, it feels like maybe it's the right time for a change.
I think playing him in a game like yesterday is fine, because he's now our third most capped goalkeeper.
Mm.
So you need someone like that with that amount of experience in those sorts of games to get you through. But long term, I agree, Jack Butland he's a top goalkeeper. And
he makes some amazing
saves.
It
might be harsh to say, but I think he's already better than Joe Hart has ever been at any point in his career.
Wow. That's
in terms of shot stopping.
He's still coming back from injury as well.
Yeah, exactly. He was gone, what was it, like a year he was out or something. Yeah.
And he the only reason he was out for that long is because he was playing for England. Do you remember? He made his injury so much worse by continuing to play on.
Yeah, so
let's talk a bit about the home nation, specifically Scotland, who now just need to beat Slovenia. And they will be in the second place playoff spot because they beat Slovakia, a Martin Skrtel own goal in the 89th minute. Hush. So they can still go through if they draw. Is that correct? And Slovakia lose, or was Slovakia playing Malta?
They need to beat Slovenia and then hope results in the other groups sort of go their way, because the way the sort of qualification works is this. Best place, second place teams.
Right, okay, yeah.
And
they're not that best placed.
No, because if they win, they're currently on 17 points. If they win, they'll be on 20.
Mm-hmm.
But teams like Portugal are already on 21 points. Northern Ireland are on 19, could end up on 22.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, get your sort of business done first and then sort of wait around and hope.
Okay.
But it's not, they're in a pretty good position. Like, you wouldn't bet against them making it if they won their game against Slovenia.
Mm.
From the performance of last night, which I caught sort of glimpses of, it was a sort of classic Hampden Scotland performance where it's just pressure, with the Scottish fans just hoping and praying that, you know, something gives, and Martin Skrtel did give away, thankfully for them.
A lot of pundits were saying that they deserve to win that, to get something from the game.
Yeah, yeah. It would have been a really sort of harsh draw to take, because it was all Scotland, and some of the scenes at full time at Hampden Park sort of.
Yeah. They know how to celebrate.
Yeah, they've seen the Irish and the English and Welsh sort of go to these tournaments for the last couple of years, and it feels like this finally could be their time. And Strachan gets a lot of stick, but with the sort of resources he's got to work with and the team selection he made yesterday, which did get criticised a fair bit.
Everyone was savaging before the game.
You know, you have to give him credit for, you know, getting as far as he has with what he's got to work with.
Wales have got Georgia, literally, I think by the time we're done with this podcast, by the time it goes out, Wales will be kicking off against Georgia. They are pretty much nailed on for second place if they continue to win their games. They're in a bit of a ding-dong battle with the Republic of Ireland. No?
Yeah. So they need to win both of their games, and they probably have to do a little bit more hoping than Scotland do.
Scotland are doing a lot already.
Yeah, and the bad thing for them is they've got to win two games without Gareth Bale, and it's just the mental side of that. Like, forget about, you know, him actually scoring the goals or whatever, but just going onto the pitch without your star man there.
Got Ben Woodburn now.
They have got Ben Woodburn. Oh, God, it would be some story if Woodburn was to, you know, score the goals that takes him there. But
well, they're playing Ireland on Monday, and I think from a neutral point of view, Adam, try to be neutral. Who would you rather see at the tournament? I mean, the Irish bring the fans, but Wales are probably more fun to watch, I guess. Ireland can be a bit dour to watch.
Yeah.
Glenn Whelan in midfield.
But their fans, I think Ireland, to be honest.
Yeah, for the fans.
Yeah, no, not just for
the Welsh fans are great. The Welsh fans were great at the Euros.
Oh, yeah, of course, but it's a bit more of an interesting story. You've got Martin O'Neill as manager as well. Mm. Roy Keane in the setup.
Yeah, he got a new contract.
Yeah, he got his new contract, so he'll be there for the Euros even after the World Cup now. So it would just be, it's an interesting one to watch them because their fans, not just for their fans, I keep mentioning it, but they do get really big.
I think Wales are maybe a little bit more tactically interesting because they've got, you know, individual quality like Ramsey, Woodburn, Ben Davies, obviously Gareth Bale.
Yeah, they are definitely, well, not definitely, but they are most likely the better footballing nation.
Ireland are a bit more workmanlike, aren't they?
Yeah. But that's what we like to see. It's like Scotland, they get through pretty much based on their fans.
Yeah.
If you compared Hampden Park yesterday to Wembley by the end of the game.
That's a very sad
point. Well, there's a video of England fans cheering a paper plane going into going into one of the goals, which tells you everything you need to know about the fans' reaction there. One more situation that we wanted to go through before we move on to the one-on-one interview with James Montague. Hirsch, you've been looking at Group I.
Yes.
For some weird reason, which you're going to explain now.
Before we got into the pod, I was just looking at, you know, the state of play around Europe and, you know, what's the most interesting group to follow the weekend? Because, you know, a lot of people sort of get sad during international breaks, haven't got exciting football to follow. Mm-hmm. But keep an eye on Group I, because you've got Croatia on top with 16 points and plus 9 goal difference.
They're top with 16 points?
Yeah.
Less than Scotland?
Yeah, wait for the rest of it. Iceland's second place with 16 points as well, but with 4 goal difference. And then below them, Turkey and Ukraine on 14 points, both on 4 goal difference.
Oh my God.
So any two of those four teams can
exactly,
go through.
Exactly, yeah. So Group I is going to be a bit of a madness.
It's going to be Turkey. It's always Turkey if you get through.
Turkey do seem to find themselves a way of getting through these major tournaments, but the fact that Iceland have broken up, you know, a Turkey, Croatia, Ukraine sort of trifecta there means, you know, the Euros a few years back wasn't quite a fluke. And, yeah, just watch that space over the weekend because that's going to be interesting.
Iceland and Turkey is my prediction there.
Yeah. Croatia's got to be
Croatia
up there.
Croatia, they're a bit decent.
I wouldn't bet against Ukraine because they've got a couple of good players now and they've got some sort of momentum going as well. So
okay, we'll keep an eye out for that. Last things last, before we move on, we've had a question from Ramzi Haddad, which is a bit of an odd one. Would you rather see Wenger manage France at the 2018 World Cup or England? France or England? And then he's asked, and why? Which I'm guessing you guys would. So if Wenger was to suddenly, despite signing a two-year contract, suddenly quit Arsenal, who would you rather he manage? So obviously the stories are that both France and England have approached Wenger multiple times about taking on the international job, probably because of Wenger's record of running a whole club, running the youth system. Who would you rather see him in charge of? England, you know, from a patriotic point of view, or France because, oh my God, all of that young talent and, you know, Wenger in charge?
Yeah, you've literally just hit the nail on the head. I'd rather see him manage France because I kind of want to see Southgate at a major tournament with England firstly. But second, you've got to see how he does. And then secondly, Wenger with all that talent. Players like Mbappe, Lamar, Griezmann, Pogba, Giroud.
And he won't lose any of them.
Exactly.
There's no contract issues. They're his.
He's wanted to manage every single one of them before. This is his chance.
How does he pick between Griezmann, Giroud and Lacazette, given he's bought two of them and he wants to buy the third?
I'm sure he'd find a way. Hush, play all of them.
I'd I'd say I think him managing England would be a bit more fascinating because, I don't know, France team, it's so talented, it almost picks itself. It's like whatever combination you put those players into the pitch, they'll do well.
But they also don't really like Didier Deschamps, the players, a lot, do they? Because he doesn't seem, or the fans don't, I should say, because he doesn't really seem to get the best out of them.
For his own sake, he should manage France because it'd be a much, you know, nicer end to his career. But in terms of what I would like to see, I'd love to see him, what he'd do with this England side, what kind of players he would pick, if he would stick with the sort of, you know, drab formation, would you try and play some more attacking football, put more emphasis on players like Stones and Lallana rather than, you know, Henderson and Cahill. And yeah,
he put Oxlade-Chamberlain at right wing back or left wing back.
Yeah. You thought you could get away.
Just seeing him manage Harry Kane,
found you. Oh wow,
that would just be worth the admission alone. Yeah. I think,
wow. Well, thanks very much for that question, Ramza. And that's pretty much all we've got time for. We're going to switch straight into the interview after this. Just going to get a little thank you from Adam.
Thank you.
And thanks from Hush for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
All right, guys, we'll see you soon. Please don't forget about Defending in Numbers, a Deezer original, made by the people who make the Squawker Talker. Guess what? That's us. Check it out on Deezer, on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. The next thing you hear will be Rory Briggs talking to James Montagu about what inspires him about football.
One of them that's kind of a common theme in all my work, I think, is the underdog. Having played football myself, being terrible, losing constantly. Yeah. I have an affinity to the losers when it comes to football, especially the goalkeepers, because I'm a terrible losing goalkeeper. And so I've always been really interested in how people set themselves up, even in the most extreme circumstances, with no hope whatsoever. But there's that sliver of something, that belief, that maybe this time will be our time. And I think part of it is supporting a team. I mean, there are much smaller teams that have all sorts of problems, you know, than West Ham United. But we're a yo-yo club. I mean, we always seem to be losing. We always seem to be on the verge of chaos. FA Cup, you know, third round, first round. These were kind of formative experiences. And the way that the British, I think, talk about underdogs, it's really part of, like, central part of our character. Like, we need to know that there's a potential for, you know, David to kind of break the crown of Goliath. We still need that, and we still see that narrative all the time in writing and television and film. So it's still that, and I rarely write about British football, English football in particular. I rarely write about the Premier League. I don't really go to many Premier League games. I mean, I don't really live in the haven't lived in the country full time for about 10 years now.
You're based in Belgrade,
but based in Serbia at the moment. But I mean, I've been in Romania and the Middle East for a long time, and I've been very lucky, I've just sought out those stories, just sought out the stories that maybe people don't see our stories, but are kind of at the margins, says something about the human condition, and maybe, you know, maybe something wider about the world as well. I mean, I started out as a political journalist and studied politics, so I kind of often see the political ramifications of sport or how the politics of society is reflected in sport, and especially football. I mean, anyone that's read Simon Cooper's work, I mean, he's hit another inspiration for me, Football Against the Enemy. I still get it's the same joy going to... I remember when I was in, I went to watch Bhutan play Sri Lanka in their first ever World Cup match. Managed to get to Sri Lanka, managed to get to Bhutan.
What was the pitch like?
Well, in Sri Lanka wasn't too bad, actually. In Bhutan, they had the most incredible stadium in Thimphu.
So I'm imagining a hillside somewhere.
It's a mountain. It's the second highest. Drop. Yeah, I mean, it's the second highest. I mean, if you've ever played Tomb Raider on the PlayStation, it's kind of like that. All these temples with these prayer wheels. It's the second highest capital city in the world. The air's thin. The architecture is just this beautiful kind of Himalayan wooden kind of crazy Bhutanese thing going on. Lots of carved penises on the walls as well, because they have this, they revere the ejaculating penis. It's kind of a symbol of, not quite virility, but it's kind of like you see it everywhere. And it's
But they don't have that on the football shirt.
They don't have that on the football shirt, but they are missing a trick with that. But you can buy carved wooden penis key rings outside, outside the ground, so you can always hit those later. But it was the most magnificent stadium I've ever been to, and it was their first World Cup home match. And there was 35,000 people, half day by the government, so everybody was off work. 35,000 people dressed in Bhutanese kind of clobber, winning their first ever game. And I remember before that game, I spoke to Sri Lanka's Serbian coach, And I said, you know, I just, it's a few hours before kickoff. I still get that when I prepare to go to a game, that excitement. And, you know, I'm packing my stuff, you know, my kit, like my using my BBC mic and a few other bits and pieces. And I'm going and I'm so excited. I mean, you must have that. And he was like, I'm jealous that you have that. He didn't have that anymore. Mm. For him, it was a job. It was a process. For me, it's still kind of the best job in the world. It's kind of a hobby.
Yeah.
And I'm just astounded that people can actually pay me and I can live.
That's the joy of it. Kind of
get by with it, you know.
So your new book, The Billionaires Club, you know, pursuing people who were at the top of the game, the hierarchy of the global game, but specifically the owners. What was the inspiration there? You've kind of gone from the outsiders to the insiders, I suppose.
It's the ultimate insiders. These are the super rich. These are the masters of the universe. These are the people that don't just control football, but control the world. And for me, I had this idea, first of all, 2008, when I did a book about football in the Middle East, When Friday Comes, and I was living in the United Arab Emirates in Dubai for almost 3 years. And I could see the rank hypocrisy within the country, within the people that lived there, whether they were expats or locals, because at the centre of that society was a system of slavery, which we've now learned from writing about Qatar and the World Cup, the kafala system, which is a system of sponsorship that traps men, mainly from Southeast Asia, in these horrific conditions. I couldn't get a single editor in the UK to care about this in Dubai. I mean, I managed to write something for The Big Issue and a few other investigations at the time.
No one would touch it?
It was kind of like, well, yeah, but I mean, the story we want to tell about Dubai is this glittering place that's sprung out of the desert, and it kind of ran counter to that. And I was like saying, I've gone to places, I've seen thousands of trafficked women in nightclubs. You know, this place, once you scratch the surface, it's morally a very disturbing and troubling place. And you saw how the royal families acquiesced in that, you know, and in terms of democracy, there's no democracy. There's no people started getting arrested for tweets. I mean, there's a real, you know, really one of the most awful in the region. And this isn't the region that's well known for its human rights, kind of adherence to human rights. I mean, this is one of the most egregious abuses of human rights in the region. And then they bought Manchester City, or the Sheikh Mansour, the president of the club, also a member of the Abu Dhabi royal family, who was integral to the government. He was in the cabinet. He was basically considered the right hand man of the president, who's the head of the Abu Dhabi royal family. And I couldn't see how people, after all the issues that Man City had with Thaksin Shinawatra about the human rights and about fit and proper persons and all this, that this guy was getting a complete, you know, free card.
Yeah.
You know, nobody was talking about, well, where is this money coming from? Why do people not think about that, whether that's important for their clubs?
So you're worried about the regulation then, I suppose.
What I'm worried about, fundamentally what it's about, is how much should football fans care about who owns their club and where the money comes from? And when you talk to most fans, it's when they're winning, it's not an issue. But when things go wrong, suddenly it is. Mm. You talk to Chelsea fans. I mean, Abramovich is incredibly popular there for everything he's done for the club. But if you look at the past 10 years of what Abramovich has been up to, when you look at the court case with Boris Berezkovsky, the largest civil litigation case in the history of the British courts, you know, this guy's a right-hand man to Putin and does his bidding. And, you know, this is a country, Russia, that is, you know, civil society is being destroyed virtually. And he's played his part in that. And I guess what I wanted to do was try to raise the flag and say, this isn't, you know, we complain when we see kind of nefarious behaviour in smaller clubs, owners come in, asset strip. But what about these other guys who have managed to hide all this? But they're hiding in plain sight. It's all out there if you want to go to it. So I decided to, I'm never going to get any interviews with these guys. I'm never going to find out anything from their inner circle. They've got that locked down. So what I wanted to find out is speak to the people who have lost, the losers, from their power and their money. So when it came to the UAE, I went to villages in Bangladesh to visit the workers who have been trafficked to the UAE, others who had been arrested and tortured and sent home for going on strike about their poor paying conditions, and try and paint a picture of what's going on there and how these characters that we see regularly talking about football are complicit in it. So it was in there, it was Qatar, Russia, Ukraine, China. China was a big one. I spent a lot of time in China looking at the kind of connections. But in each case, it was how did it, with China, I went to Ardo Den Haag, who had been bought out by a Chinese owner, and how that's been affected by the money, and then try to see how normal people like me and you are, you know, have had their lives ruined by the investment, and often cloaked in the extremely kind of positive message, but in the end they pay for it in the end. And and I think it's a warning as well about where the game's headed, and where not just the game, I think the world, in terms of the power that the super rich can wield.
In terms, what, in terms of sort of a global proxy, using the Premier League as a proxy?
Yeah, for, I mean, these, I mean, this isn't, at the end, I think what you discover is that there isn't any, at first there's geographical differences. I look at the Chinese, I look at, I split the world into kind of four areas, America, Eastern Europe, Asia, but primarily looking at China and the Middle East. And by the end, you realise that it's kind of the same money and the same investments, people in the same cities doing the same things. This is a separate class of people who are controlling not just football, but banking and media and all sorts of areas. And there's so little transparency about what they're doing. Yet when you look at in their home countries, how they've risen and how they've used their power when they're there, I think it's telling that what you learn there, I think, is a warning to the future of not just the game, but also for the future of, I mean, I don't want to say it's grand to say the future of democracy, humanity. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I can't see it getting any better. I can't see their wings being clipped anytime soon, especially given what's happening with the elections in America and other places. So it's... So yeah, it was quite an emotional journey because you go into refugee camp, you go to I managed to sneak into some of the worker camps in Qatar, speaking to people. I mean, people whose lives have been absolutely ruined by this system. It was draining. You saw a lot of kind of unhappiness. So it's not a happy-go-lucky book.
No. But it's out in May.
It's out in May, hopefully, if the lawyers say it's okay.
Good, let's hope for that. You're going back to your first book, I'm right in thinking When Friday Comes.
Yeah.
Looking at The Outsider and, you know, looking at some, spending a lot of time in these countries and going to the games, the big derbies, the fierce rivalries. What's the best game you've ever seen live?
I mean, in the Middle East or everywhere?
Everywhere. I suppose with your experience of going across so many different continents.
The one that I always think about, there were two actually. One was Egypt-Algeria World Cup qualifier in 2009, and this was I wrote about this in the book and for 442 as well. I mean, this was just one of those experiences you'll never forget. It was called, there was a lot of history between Egypt and Algeria. In 1990, or I think it was 89, the two played to reach the World Cup finals in Italy. But Egypt were kind of really small team, hadn't qualified. I think they'd had like a qualifying game in the 30s or whatever, but they had never, you know, really qualified for a major tournament like that. And Algeria had that great team of the kind of 1980s that should have gone further in 82. And it was called the Death Match. It was kind of riots at the game. Egypt won.
Funny because they're not neighbouring countries.
They're not neighbouring countries.
This is all football related.
This is all football related. So I mean, there is in the Maghreb, in the north, there is a rivalry. You go to see, Morocco and Tunisia, you know, have a huge rivalry. All those countries have a big rivalry with each other. But there was the team doctor, Egyptian team doctor, lost his eye after being glassed on the pitch, and his name escapes me now. But the famous Lakhdar Barami, I think his name is, the famous Algerian midfielder from that era. He was blamed for it. So there was an Interpol arrest warrant, international arrest warrant. So he couldn't leave Algeria for years. And there's a lot of bad blood about this. And then it came down to this one game in Cairo. And it was kind of rehash of all this past history. The Cairo International Stadium, it had like, there was like 110,000 people there. And it was, I mean, it was quite frightening on in the run up because you saw the full weight of Mubarak's state, police state, the press, everything, whipping the population into this kind of anti-Algerian fever, which came to a crescendo in this game. And the atmosphere, I remember having to get into the stadium because back then I would never go and sit in the press box. I'd always go and sit with the fans because you'd get a much better atmosphere and it was just better watching the games like that. And I was in behind the goal. You had to get there six hours before kickoff. I remember I'd been sick for a few days, so I wasn't in the best of health. And I just took loads of Imodium just in case I didn't shit myself.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there and a couple of mates were there and this game approached and the atmosphere was like unlike anything I've ever seen. And they had to win by two clear goals so for all the points to be equal in the group and they would have to have another playoff. So it came down to this game and they scored. I think they scored in the first couple of minutes. I think it might have even been Amir Zaki that scored. And then the game was terrible for the rest. It was one of the most abject games of football I've ever seen. I think it was the fifth minute of injury time, the final, one of the final kicks of the game, they score and it's 2-0 and it means that there's going to be a playoff. And just the explosion of joy and anger and relief. It was just, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking of it now. I mean, it was, you know, there were riots afterwards. I know the Algerian team bus was attacked and there's all sorts of other incidents. But I mean, I'll never forget that. And then the other, watching Libya qualify for the African Cup of Nations during the war.
What year was it? 2011, yeah.
And this was still chaos back home. A lot of the players had been fighting on the front lines. And had come back for the team to qualify, and they were playing the Zambia in northern Zambia, and I managed to get on the team flight from Tunisia. They let me go with them, so I managed to get into Zambia with them. And I was in the dressing room. They draw 0-0, and it was a really tense game, and they had to wait for other results to go their way. And I was sitting there in silence with the players, and they were just sitting there waiting, and it seemed to go on for an eternity. And the kit man came in and just like screaming. I think Nigeria had lost to Guinea or something. Yeah. And it was everything. It was the war. It was this outpouring of just incredible emotion. They'd made it. And that was, I think those two matches, I can remember, ironically, both of them being pretty bad games. But in terms of everything that was around it, it was, yeah.
If you had to pick a favourite out of the two?
Probably the Egypt game, just because it had the early goal, it had the late goal. Yeah. You know, it was in a way, they had earned that replay. They ended up obviously losing the replay in Sudan, but the other one I think was, I mean, it was a game where they were kind of watching what was going on elsewhere. So this was I think the one in Cairo was the favourite one.
Well, having read When Friday Comes, there's some pretty odd situations you get yourself into, some hairy situations, but some quite comical ones as well. What do you think is the strangest experience you've had covering football?
Well, the thing is, I mean, a lot of the stuff ends up not being about football at all. You know, you're going there nominally on a football story, and then it ends up being something completely different. I mean, covering Egypt, for instance, and the revolution and everything that involved the fans and the ultras of Al Ahly and the Port Said massacre, where 92 fans were killed. 72 fans were killed. There was about a year where there was no football in Egypt. So there was a year when I was in Egypt and there was just sitting around. I was going to protests. I was on the front lines in Tahrir Square. I was watching people burn down police vans in the middle of the square. I'd go to Alexandria with the ultras of Al Ahly and go to these marches and these rallies. You know, and there was a point where I was like, I mean, I can't remember the last time I've seen Egypt play. I mean, it was or Egypt or any of the club teams. So there are, I mean, for When Friday Comes, one of the funniest, and one, it's kind of bittersweet. It's quite poignant now. I went to Yemen in 2007, I think it was. And I went there because there was a problem with khat, which is this leaf drug that people chew. And everybody chews cats, and it's like taking. Do you remember a few years ago? There's a drug. I think it's methadrone. They called it meow meow.
The legal high.
The legal high that then got made illegal. It's the same active ingredient in that. So when you chew it, it's like kind of smoking weed and taking ecstasy at the same time. So you kind of up and down, up and down. Mm. And it really, I mean, it really messes with you.
Yeah.
You know, so I went there because I'd found it in a newspaper, a story about how all the players had been banned from taking part in a, I think either an Olympic qualifier or kind of under 23 game, where they took a drug test and all of them failed it because they'd been taking this this leaf which grows at a certain altitude within Yemen.
And they just chew it, don't they?
They just chew it, and you chew it for hours and hours and hours, and you kind of lose your teeth, and you kind of, it's like chewing tobacco, except it completely mashes you
up. There's a similar one in Myanmar and Burma where people the betel nut, they chew it and they get red teeth.
This is it. But imagine, I mean, there's nothing, there's, I mean, not even coca leaves are as strong as this. This is real, you know, it's really powerful. You can feel the waves of this stuff like affecting you. And you see, I was in Sana'a, and everything stops at 1 o'clock and everybody goes to the market, because when you pick the leaves, it's only got a few hours before it's completely useless. So it's you know, really, you know, active when, as soon as you picked it. So they get down there, spend all their money on it, and then they're out. They're just on the floor. You know, and you see doorways, people slumped everywhere, or they go back home, but they don't do anything. And I met this kind of, the head of the FA there, this Elliot Ness character, who had decided they're not going to chew cat anymore. We're going to have a modern football team and a modern FA and a modern league. And we spent the day together, lovely guy, Hamad. We went everywhere. He showed me everywhere around Sadab, met his friends, showed me the doctors, all the stuff they were doing. And then at the end of the day, he said, right, let's come back to mine. It was Friday, go back to his. He has a majlis, which is this little kind of room within a house where you greet your guests. And he just pulled out some bags of like top quality cat. And it just showed me how deep it was, because even the head of the FA couldn't
having said all this.
Having said all that, you know, was bang on it as well. So we ended up chewing it. And I mean, before I know it, 8 hours have gone, and we've talked about how we're going to revolutionize Yemeni football. We're going to kind of have a Premier League style makeover and all this. And then you stop chewing and you have this crack, the come down and you crash. And then you just want to leave as quickly as possible. Most of them end up drinking whiskey to kind of like cure their shakes. You know, it was sad, because you think, now I went to a league game and it was a great match. I mean, there's good 10,000-15,000 people had turned up for this league game, and now it's a war zone. And the Saudis and the British government complicit in it, the American government too, in the arms sales to the Saudis are, you know, it's a forgotten, brutal conflict. And I often think of my time in Sana'a and Hamad and all the players. And
what are they doing now? What's the situation with the football team?
Well, with the football team, is when they had the World Cup qualification, they couldn't have any games there, and the airport was held by the rebels. So they had to take a merchant ship from Aden to Djibouti. So there's this picture one of the players put on Twitter of them on this, you know, like a cargo ship. Yeah. They're all on the cargo ship going to Djibouti, where from there they would then fly to, I can't remember who they were playing. It might have even been Myanmar. And they had to fly, and they lost every, they had played their home games in Qatar. But I think they lost almost every one of their games. They didn't make it. The game is ruined. I think Hamad's still alive, but it's very difficult communication. So I can't, you know, I mean, but I'm next year, I'm going to make it my job to find out how they're all doing and try and go to a game. So I think they've got some Asian Cup qualifiers next year. So I'm going to catch up with them. But that's a memory that I'll never forget.
Bizarre. So then the next book, looking again at the outsiders, but covering a bit more across the globe. 31-0, named after the scoreline between American Samoa and Australia, wasn't it, in 2003 or 2001?
2001.
Which you've probably seen the film, the documentary film.
I was there.
Next Goal Wins.
I was there. That was Next Goal Wins. I turned up for this tournament, for this, which is written about in the book, because I thought I have to go and do a story. I have to do a chapter about American Samoa if my book's going to be called 31-0. And I remember I had a tiny advance and I stretched it out. I mean, I think I had to go to Rwanda first, and then I managed to get myself it took me like 6 stops and I ended up in Samoa. And I thought, I've only got a day before this first match of this World Cup qualification campaign that they've got. But luckily I crossed the international dateline, so I didn't realise I'd actually gained a day. So this is great, I can prepare for it. And they had a tournament, Tonga, Cook Islands and Samoa. alongside American Samoa, the worst four teams.
Big rivals, though. Samoa versus American Samoa.
Exactly. It's one. Well, I mean, one's an American dependency. The other one's a kind of a sovereign state. But yeah, I mean, tribally, culturally, very similar. Mm. So I turn up and I just walk into the American Samoa camp, and there's Thomas Rongen, this big white-haired Dutch coach, who at first I think is American because he's got such an American accent, but he's been living in America for years. He used to play.
Funnily enough, about him, we did a list of the best football documentaries to watch before we die, and he actually responded because we included Next Goal Wins, and he was just very happy, very thanked us for his inclusion.
He's a
very nice guy.
He is an absolute. At first, I thought he was going to be like one of these kind of hotheads, like give the hair dryer, but I met him and he was just this. He's this kind of chain smoking. I mean, he kicks ass. He needs to, but he's just got heart of gold.
Because it comes across when he's coaching. Yeah, when you watch him coach these players. He's there's nothing you can get past this guy.
No, you can't. I mean, you can't. I mean, he was luckily I brought some. He'd run out of cigarettes at that point. He smokes filterless Camels, and he'd run out of filterless Camels. He didn't have any cigarettes. But I brought some roll ups. So I've never seen anybody roll fatter roll-ups. It was like this thick. I mean, obviously this is a podcast, so you can't see my fingers, but maybe an inch and a half thick, where he was just without a kind of filter. And he knocked these boys into shape. And I remember doing an interview straight. He let me in straight away, got great access. And then straight away, I don't want this to sound sexist, but I remember like this really beautiful woman walking past, and I remember I just remember seeing her in the corner of my eye.
Oh no, I think I know where this is going.
And he said, oh yeah, that's our centre back who's starting tomorrow or the next day. And it was Jaya, the transgender centre back they had. And so then this whole universe opened up. It wasn't just a story about this team that always lost. It wasn't even about the fact that Nicky Salapi, the goalkeeper, who was the goalkeeper that let in those 31 goals, was there as well, psychologically absolutely ruined by this experience. But there was also this transgender centre-back, a member of the Fafafina, which is this third sex that is recognised in Polynesian culture. And I met the boys who were there filming Next Goal Wins. If you watch Next Goal Wins, you can see me in the background because I was in various places kind of ruining their shots.
Just hiding in the corner.
I mean, they interviewed me for it, but they obviously that hit the cutting room floor quite quickly. So, but that was, I mean, that I would say in terms of another game that I'll never forget is the first game that I went to there, and they played Tonga. And everybody was expecting, there was 20 people in the crowd, but the first ever victory and seeing them win that game and being there for this moment that nobody saw at the time, but obviously became kind of iconic moment in this film, was beautiful. Yeah. And it, to me, that showed me more. I mean, I knew how powerful football is and what it means to me, but seeing that, implore anybody who complains about underdogs or kind of, football's about the elite and just about the elite, go and watch this documentary, Next Goal Wins, and you'll see just what it means for these players when they beat Tonga, which for most people would be considered something very simple to do. But for them, it was the highlight of their life.
People talk a lot about magic in football, the magic of the cup, the FA Cup being, touted as a sort of magical experience. But what were your ultimate magical moments in football?
I think the American Samoa game, I talked a bit about the first game when they won their first ever game, which was just a beautiful moment. Almost the one that I'll remember more is the third game, because it was a four-team tournament, and they'd won their first game, they drew their second game, and suddenly from being the worst team in the world, they then had a shot at qualifying for the next round. And what was amazing was that they went into that game against Samoa. It was a kind of local derby. And seeing how they'd improved when they'd started to believe in themselves and what it meant to try to qualify for a World Cup final, what it meant, what this tournament meant for them as people, but also for the people who were there watching them. And it came down to, effectively, it was 0-0, and it came down to the last couple of minutes. They had a chance, and they should have scored, and they should have won, and it hit the post. And they eventually ended up losing. Conceding in the 90th minute, and the rain came down and there was tears, and it was just such an emotional moment. But that was that was kind of lightning in the bottle, that moment. You know, it was beautiful. And I think that was probably the most magical thing I've ever seen in football, I think. I mean, a lot of the other stuff is, you know, there's been moments of magic, but there's also been a kind of an element of tragedy to it, or sometimes farce. But this was pure. This was absolutely the purest, most beautiful thing I've seen.
There was no sinister undertone.
There was nothing. Just, there was no... Even we were playing in the JS Blatter Stadium, you know, it was... and it was... I mean, I'm not one of these guys that kind of bashes Blatter all the time. I mean, I think FIFA has got its own problems. I think Blatter's been caught in the middle of it, a lot of it, but... And I share many of his globalist views about how football should be expanded around the world, which is at odds with how many people here see it. But there was nothing cynical about it. It was wonderful, and I wish more people could have felt it. But thankfully, if you go and watch Next Goal Wins or read 31-0, you maybe capture a little bit of it for yourself.
Exactly. Well, probably Blatter, probably not an answer to this next question. But who is the most inspirational person you've met in football?
I think there's a couple. I mean, I when I was in the West Bank for the first time, and I met Hani Talgir, the captain of the Palestinian women's national team, and how they were trying desperately to put this team together. And they're trying to overcome so many difficult issues. You know, not just problems amongst kind of say the Muslim community, because they insisting that women should cover when they played, but also in the Christian community in the Palestinian territories, because they didn't think it was very becoming of a woman to play football. So they were battling their own communities to try to play. They were battling the occupation because they had very difficulties moving around, playing places. They couldn't go to Jerusalem. They couldn't go to play any games abroad because they couldn't leave, and there'd be threats of arrest and issues of terrorism and poverty and all these kind of things. And at the middle, you had this incredible woman, Honey, who was the captain, who was brilliant as well. I mean,
how old was she? She's like, she was early in teens.
She was a bit older than the other girls. She was early 20s.
Okay.
And I met her at Bethlehem University where she was studying. So, I mean, maybe 21 actually when I met her. And, you know, watching that team, I remember their first, one of the first trainings I went to, and it was, they played on this, it was a basketball court, concrete basketball court with, I mean, they just had, you know, jumpers for goalposts, and it was covered in broken glass, which we had to clean up beforehand. And, you know, despite all the issues, all the political issues, there were times when I was out there when the Hamas Fatah schism that took place, that created this, you know, break between the two groups, between Gaza and the West Bank, took place. And there was fighting and people being killed, and, you know, they got stuck in Jordan. I remember seeing them. They couldn't get back into the country. All of this, yet this woman was this figurehead, and through sheer force of will managed to keep this kind of team together, and was a brilliant figurehead for it. And eventually, I remember a few years later, you know, they had built up to the point where they had their first ever home international in the West Bank, in the Faisal Al-Husseini Stadium in Ramallah, and right next to the wall. The wall skirts it a few metres away, the separation barrier. And she was, you know, she was there. She was the captain. There was maybe 13,000 fans there watching it, which you wouldn't see for many women's football games in Europe, you know, let alone in the occupied territories. And it was, for me, meeting her, seeing her vision and seeing how it was kind of implemented. And now she's working for FIFA. She's retired now. She's working for FIFA trying to help other girls and women like her to play the game. And I can't think of a... I mean, Bob Bradley's another character who many people now know because of the US and also because of Swansea. But I got to see him up close dealing with the Egyptian national team during the revolution, dealing with players who had witnessed horrific things during the Port Said massacre, where 72 people were killed in this very suspicious incident after a football match. And many of those players had fans dying in their arms, including Mohamed Abu Trekka, the famous midfielder who was his main player in the Egyptian national team. And he had to bring all these kind of players, damaged players, and deal with this kind of faltering revolution at the same time. And he did it with so much grace and did it with so much class. The only thing that didn't work out was there was one game against Ghana where they lost 6-1, and that was the end of they'd won every game, and that was the only thing that was the only thing that kind of asterisk next to that time. But having seen him and seeing how he operated, I thought this is somebody special. It's a special human.
Yeah.
You can argue about coaching methods and everything like that, but in terms of a human.
Talking of other writers, finally, just to wrap things up, we've got a chance for you to suggest three books that we have to read, three other football books.
One of my favourite football books of all time is Gary Imlach, My Father and Other Working Class Heroes. I thought that was, for me, that reading that, this was before I was a football journalist, and it was so heartfelt and so smart. And first person stuff doesn't usually, it sometimes can leave you very cold. And I knew Gary Imlach. I used to love American football back in the day. So he was, you know, I remember his name from when he was doing the Channel 4 American football stuff. I was a big Houston Oilers fan, I remember, at the time, because we'd lost the Premier League. We'd lost the football then, and we didn't have Sky. So I remember the first thing, I think they had Kabaddi on Channel 4, then Italian football, then American football. And I knew Gary Imlach from that. And so I would thoroughly recommend that. It would be, the second one would almost certainly have to be Football Against the Enemy by Simon Cooper. I think that's the granddad of all the you know, this kind of subgenre that I think I'd hopefully consider myself part of, which is foreign football writing that tries to tell a little bit more about than just the football.
That was his first book, wasn't it?
That was his first book, and it still holds up when you read it.
What's it about?
He basically travels. I mean, there's no kind of narrative, like there's no connecting thread in a way. It's just going to different places around the world and trying to explain how football, football and politics is very reflective. You can understand about the world through football, and you forget kind of back then what a huge thing that was, because a lot of people were writing about football, either it was player biographies, but in a very, like, you're kind of like an idiot. And he brought a kind of political sensibility to it, and a social kind of lens that I thought was, really that changed the way I wanted to do things.
Suddenly you thought, here's my avenues going. Well,
funnily enough, when I first had the idea for When Friday Comes, I was kind of, the first book I read that kind of made me think I could do this was a book called Baghdad Without a Map, which is about an American, young American foreign correspondent in the Middle East and his kind of adventures. But then I read that and it was kind of, somebody's done it. And then I read it and I was like, yeah, this is it. This is what I've got to do. And then, you know, I think it won't be any surprise, The Ball Is Round by David Goldblatt. I mean, The Game of Our Lives won the William Hill last year. It's another great book. Mm. I'll read everything he'd write, even if it was kind of menu.
So The Ball Is Round is a sort of general history of football,
that doesn't even do it justice.
No.
I mean, it's like a 1,000-word tour de force of political, social and football analysis of every corner of the world. It's just, it was magnificent, you know.
What was your favourite part of it?
We went to Lebanon. So I was very much interested in the Middle Eastern sections of it at first, but it was the broad scope of it. That was it. What I was most excited about by it was just how vast it was. I mean, you could choose 10 places like Simon Cooper did, and you know, but this blew the doors off. This was like, anything is possible. You know, you can write anything. You know, it was like. You know, you're watching kind of an analog television and suddenly you've got the internet. You know, it was just, and it just expanded my mind and expanded what my ambition of what is possible to write. And I think rather than picking out a specific chapter, I think that for me was what it did. It was an expansion of my horizon.
It all made sense.
And it all made sense. And you think that somebody's work can have that effect on you, and it wouldn't just be me. There'd be millions of people out there, you know. And I think he's won the William Hill. I think he doesn't get enough credit here. I think, I mean, he's hugely well known and respected in the US, and you know, I'd like to see him more. When you see kind of pundits and commentators and the kind of ex professionals, and it seems a lot of it's a very simplistic.
You'd like to see more renowned writers of that stature come on.
Absolutely. I think he'd definitely shake it up. He's just this garrulous character with
with big dreadlocks and, you know, I'd love to see him next to Jamie Redknapp. I think it'd be a marriage made in heaven.
Oh, sounds fantastic, yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in today.
You're welcome.
All the best for the Billionaires Club. I hope to see it, mate. I'll pre-order it anyway.
Thank you very much.
So,
as long as I don't get assassinated before.
No, let's hope not. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you very much, James Montague, for coming in for an episode of One on One. We'll be back every 2 weeks interviewing people about their love of the game. So stay tuned, keep posted, and we'll catch you very soon.